On Life After Death by Elizabeth Kubler Ross. Part 4. Death of a Parent. The death of a loved one is always a sad event. The resulting behavior of the next of kin depends on many different factors: the age of the deceased, as well as that of the surviving child, is very relevant. The cause and or suddenness, lack of preparedness, plays an important role. The relationship between the parent and the surviving child, as well as the degree of previous similar events in the child's experiences, will all affect the bereavement period which will follow the death of a parent. If the child is very young and has had little time for bonding with the parental figure, almost any parent substitute, like a grandma, can relatively easily replace a young mother, and the infant will not suffer or show any signs of mourning, which can only take place when the baby's emotional quadrant has already developed. In the first months of life, the physical needs of the baby are the most important, and, as long as they are met with a certain consistency, warmth, and love, the baby will be satisfied. Once the bonding has taken place, a baby deprived of the mother will react with physical symptoms, crying and inability to sleep, clinging to other familiar figures, and a regression into earlier behavior can take place. It is a preschool child who will react worse when a mother and or father dies suddenly. For such a child, death cannot be perceived as a permanent happening, and he or she has no concept of death as a permanent separation. They will look for the missing parent everywhere. They will actually try to bribe them to come back. They may be convinced that they caused the disappearance of a mother, sure that mother was angry at them, thus trying to punish them with what they perceive as a temporary disappearing act. They may suddenly become unusually well-behaved, volunteer to wash the dishes, to make a bed, to clean up the dishes, and adults may be impressed by this helpful little guy who suddenly becomes such a helpful child. This is ominous behavior, as it covers up guilt and fear over earlier real or imagined misbehavior, and is an attempt to appease mommy, to bribe her to come back home. It is important for grown-ups to become aware of this behavior and neither compliment the child too much for being such a good child, nor discourage them. A repeated statement that one cannot cause mommy's death by thinking or behavior may eventually sink in. It is only when the surviving parent, or perhaps a grandparent, has had a good talk and a good cry over the death of the child's parent that the child can give himself permission to acknowledge the death of one of the parents and begin the actual mourning process. If families can cry and talk together about the happy memories they share of the much-missed person, the real process of bereavement can be greatly enhanced. Every child needs to have someone he can talk to about the person he lost. If relatives can go through the pages of a photograph book and share memories of places, vacations, incidents, and laugh and cry together, much can be done to help the child to get through the mourning process without scars. A third grader shared with me her grief over the loss of her mother in a car accident, which also killed her 3-year-old and only brother. Her father was the driver of the vehicle, and he felt extremely guilty about the tragic double loss which he felt he had caused by not listening to those in the family who had tried to talk him out of the fatal trip. Susie told me, "I was sick in bed when my dad came in to tell me that a babysitter would arrive shortly to take care of me while he, Mom, and Peter would have to be away for a few hours." Susie started sobbing again, just as she had a year ago when her father informed her of the planned short trip. "I screamed at Dad, telling him that I was sick, that I needed Mom at home, that I needed no babysitter, but he did not want to hear my objections. "Be a big girl," he said. "We will all be home when you wake up in the morning, and by then, hopefully, you will feel better." No arguing or crying helped. He was determined to drive upstate without giving any reason why this had to be done today of all days. The doctor had been in earlier and told my parents to keep me in bed and under observation, as he did not quite know what was wrong with me. I heard my mom and dad discuss the trip outside my bedroom, and it was obvious that Mom would rather stay at home. Since they did not know what was wrong with me, they decided to take my little brother along with them. I was extremely upset, crying and carrying on, but nothing helped. Mom came in and hugged me goodbye. She smiled, but she looked very sad. "Honey, be a good girl. Let Laura read you a story and rest as much as you can. I will be back before you wake up in the morning, and we will have breakfast together." Then she left quickly. Peter hollered, "So long," from the hallway. Then I heard the car pull out of the driveway. This was the last time I saw my mother and brother. Somewhere during the night, my father hit a telephone pole. The car was turned around and fell down an embankment. Apparently, a passerby saw the skid marks and followed the tracks, finding my father, still inside the car, in a daze. My mother and little brother were thrown out of the vehicle. They were rushed to a hospital. My mother was dead, but my brother lived for 2 days before he died. My father had just a few scratches and was kept for observation for a possible head injury. He came home 3 days later. All I remember is that nobody told me anything. My babysitter stayed overnight, and the next morning all our neighbors came with toys and gifts, and no one would answer my questions. My mommy promised to have breakfast with me, I kept saying, and I refused to eat. When my doctor came later in the day, I became very agitated. I did not want to see him without Mom in the room, but of all the cars that pulled up outside, none was our car. I could see the driveway from my bedroom window. The doctor gave me a shot, and all I remember is crying for my mom. 3 days later, Dad came home. He looked different. I knew that he had cried. It was only after the funeral that he told me that Mom and Peter died in a car accident, and he hoped I would be a big girl and help him. I was not willing to believe him. I spent days in bed daydreaming, talking to Mom and asking her to come back home. I even promised to prepare breakfast for her, and to forget that she did not come back to keep her promise to me. I cleaned up my drawers and my whole bedroom, folded my shorts and blouses. We had always disagreed about keeping my room a bit neater. Now all my toys sat up on the shelf, the drawers looked neat. She would have to be pleased with me and come back home. I don't think I ate anything for several days. Lots of neighbors came and left. An aunt of mine came and stayed for several weeks, but I wanted nothing to do with her. I just wanted my mommy's back home. Whenever I wanted to talk with Dad about her, he became very angry. Once, he yelled at me and asked me why I did not miss my brother. To tell you the truth, I don't think I ever thought about him. I wanted my mommy back, and all the rest of the world did not interest me until I found my mommy again. In the meantime, her father mourned the death of his beloved son and rarely allowed himself to think of his wife. His guilt was so overwhelming, his grief so immense, that he was only able to cope with one at a time, as he had described it. Had father and daughter been able to mourn together for his wife, her mother, I am sure the result would have been less devastating, the denial less extreme. The loss could have been shared, and communication between father and daughter could have been re-established. As it was, 1 year after the tragic double death, the father became more and more withdrawn, and he finally sent his only surviving child to her grandparents. She had to start in a new school, thus losing the few girlfriends she had in her old school district. There, she started to tell elaborate make-believe stories about her parents, who temporarily had to move far away, but had promised to return at the end of the school year, when she would return to her old home. She remained a loner, was often found to be extremely withdrawn, and still showed signs of great anxiety when cars pulled in or out of the driveway. She still had nightmares and, when she felt unobserved, would talk for very long times to an invisible person in a most animated fashion. When asked with whom she had such long conversations, she denied having talked to anyone. In my earlier book, On Children and Death, I told the story of a boy whose mother had died, and who was caught putting a big red apple on a windowsill in the midst of winter in Chicago. When asked what this apple was doing there, he bashfully stated, "Mommy always loved red apples. Maybe she will see it and come back home." In our 5-day live-in workshops, which are held throughout the world, we try to help people get in touch with old, unfinished business. The loss of a parent is often the beginning of difficulties experienced later on in life. The inability to talk, share, and tell about the beloved and much-missed parent sets the tone for future inability to share emotions and to learn, at an early age, to cope with loss and grief in a healthy fashion. If the surviving parent only knew how helpful it would have been for the child to show his sadness, to share tears together, later misery and negative patterns could be avoided. Older children learn quickly when their behavior creates sadness or embarrassment for the rest of the family. They cry at night into the pillow or go for long, lonely walks during which they often talk to the deceased parent. Trying to keep a lid on their emotions in the presence of other family members makes them awfully short-tempered and vulnerable to outbursts of tears for the smallest reason. They get into fights with schoolmates and sometimes openly resent other children who are picked up from school or for an outing by their parents. They become defiant daredevils in racing bicycles or go-karts, refusing to listen to adults who warn them to be more careful. Pre-adolescents who lose a parent have a tendency to act out, become overly promiscuous, run away from home, and get themselves into very dangerous life situations. Many of the adolescent prostitutes, who earn a marginal living by selling themselves, run away from home after the death of a parent. "I don't care a hoot" is a prevailing attitude, another form of denial. What they need the most is a pair of loving arms around them, a shoulder to lean on, and a grown-up who can give them permission to sob their hearts out. "I am not a baby anymore," is what they often say, but that is exactly what they are wishing to experience, to be babied, rocked, cradled, and loved until their hurt begins to heal. It takes time to heal. It takes time to mourn. It doesn't matter how many weeks or months have passed. Everybody needs to be encouraged to take his time, to do it his way. What work does for some, sleep will do for others. Party going may be the answer for some teenagers, or adding a grotesque amount of makeup. Never judge or criticize anyone who tries to cope with the loss of a parent in his own way. There are coping mechanisms which may work for them that are inconceivable for you. In families where there is a lot of fighting, physical punishment, and/or abuse, a lack of open and honest communications followed a sudden death. These families will have to work on a lot of unfinished business before healthy mourning can take place. Many men and women who had been sexually abused in their childhood, a minimum of 30% in our population, finally get in touch with their long-suppressed rage, their sense of unfairness, and their immense grief over the childhood they never had. Such children in mourning without a previous history of losses will have to learn first what it is that makes them almost chronically depressed, untrusting, and withdrawn. Only after acknowledging the trauma, or multiple traumas of sexual abuse, can they be helped by expressing their hate, rage, aggression, and pain, their fear, grief, and guilt on an inanimate object, our technique, that is, shredding a telephone book to pieces, externalizing all their pent-up feelings they had kept locked inside for decades. Once this old unfinished business is expressed in a safe environment, in the presence of a supporting and unafraid helper, then will they begin the mourning process and cry for the death of a father they may have loved as much as they feared or resented him. If only we could help children in the early years and get them the help they need as soon as a trauma occurs, much unnecessary suffering could be avoided. In contrast to sudden, unexpected deaths, which are usually much more difficult to deal with, death by cancer or other slowly developing illnesses with a fatal outcome give the surviving children a chance to make up for the past misbehavior, to ask for forgiveness for months or years of silent treatment, or simply gives them an opportunity to solve old unfinished business with a dying parent. With so many young people now dying of AIDS, parents have an opportunity to do the same thing for their dying young adult children. Many a father who rejected his son for his homosexuality finally showed up during the last days of a son's life in order to avoid having to carry the guilt for the rest of his life. My most moving memory of such a moment was a father who literally hung around a hospital ward where his 23-year-old son was dying. He refused to go in and face him, but he showed up every single day. One evening, shortly before the end of visiting hours, an orderly noticed him again. He stood behind the father and gently moved him to the door of his son's room. "Just come in with me and take a glimpse at him," he said ever so softly, opening the door at the same time. The father looked, and shocked at the appearance of the skeleton-like figure in the bed, abruptly stated, "This is not my son." A very small voice came from near the pillow. "Yes, Dad, it's me, Richard, your son." The father hesitated, made a shy step towards his son, and minutes later their tears mingled as he leaned over his son, saying over and over again, "I'm sorry. I'm sorry." I have never seen Richard with such a beaming expression on his face. "I knew you would come before it was too late," he said. "Now I can let go and die in peace." Another young mother I remember was from Minneapolis. She knew her days were numbered, and although she had discussed her death and funeral with her husband, she never seemed to find the right words to explain to her children that she would not be around for the coming year. One night, she pulled all her courage together and invited one after the other of her children to join her on the big king-size bed. With Susie, her 9-year-old, it was easy. They had always talked openly about a lot of things, and Susie knew inside that her mom was not getting well. The mother explained to her daughter that after her death, she would always be in touch with her, and could hear her prayers and would be aware of her needs. Susie said, very matter-of-factly, "I know that you can read every thought of mine, hear every word I speak to you, although I cannot always hear your answer. That is not what bothers me. Do you think Dad will bring another woman into our house who we will have to call Mommy?" They laughed and cried together, and Susie was promised an evening discussion with Dad to make sure, should such a thing ever occur, that Susie would not be forced to call the other woman Mommy. Her son, Peter, had very different concerns. who would cook dinner for them, and who would come to his games. A heart-to-heart talk helped the whole family to prepare for Mom's eventual transition, and each one felt better for having had a chance to talk openly about this eventuality. Adults facing the loss of their elderly parents would do well to discuss such an eventuality before a stroke or heart attack forces them to think about it. If they could sit and discuss the wishes of their parents with regard to treatment, hospitals they would prefer, funeral homes, estate, and such in a calm, loving fashion with all the family members involved, it would go a long way to prepare them and save them a lot of worries and concerns. When all these decisions have been made ahead of time, in writing, when everybody present can be witness, not forced to think about such things in the midst of grief, shock and emotional turmoil can be lessened. Death is but a transition from this life to another existence, where there is no more pain and anguish. All the bitterness and disagreements will vanish, and the only thing that lives forever is love. So love each other now, for we never know how long we will be blessed with the presence of those who gave us life, no matter how imperfect many a parent has been. Everything can be bearable when there was love. This is perhaps the most important fact when we are dealing with the death of a parent. With the exception of tiny infants, every child will mourn the loss of a mother or father, even when they are grown and parents themselves. The most significant variable of a relatively uncomplicated bereavement period or a prolonged and traumatic mourning depends to a great deal on the relationship the child and parent had, on the old, unresolved conflicts that they carried within, on the level of communication they had. Last, but not least, is a mourner's earlier experiences with death and loss.